Now he was paying for it. "I can get the money," Thomas said. "That's very good news, Chris. Why don't you do that? I need time. We all need time, Chris. But we don't all get it." "No, listen," Thomas said. "I really do. I have a very large piece of money coming to me very soon. I'm very happy for you. But I need something now. I don't have it now, but I will. I'll have all of it very soon." Nothing in the soft laughter that came from the man in the back seat was funny. "You know how often I hear that." "It's true," Thomas insisted. Reluctantly, he told the man about the canvases that would soon disappear and the large bag of cash that would take their place. Silence. A long and uncomfortable silence came from the back seat. Then, "And this happens when?"
"Tomorrow. I should have the money within the week, all the money."
Another long silence followed, and Thomas felt a slow drop of sweat crawl down his neck, in spite of the chill in the car. Finally, the man spoke.
"I would hate to think you're yanking my chain, Chris. I swear to you, because you are really pissing off some very serious people. I swear," Thomas repeated. "Give me your hand."
Thomas blinked at the strange request.
What?
"Your hand. Give me it." Slowly, awkwardly, Thomas extended his hand into the back seat. The man took it and held it. And for a moment, the small hard circle of steel at Thomas's neck disappeared.
"I'm going to believe you just this once. And I hope this isn't stupid of me."
"No, I really," Thomas said, but the man took hold of Thomas's little finger and interrupted him.
"Don't disappoint me."
The man pulled upward, hard, and the sound of the little finger snapping filled the car. Thomas cried out. The pain was intense, and he tried to pull away his injured hand, but the man held on.
"Do you understand what I'm saying?"
the man said, wiggling the broken finger.
I understand." "You sure?"
the man said, with an extra vigorous tweak of the finger.
"Yes, I'm positive. 1 week.
The man dropped the finger, opened the back door of the car, and disappeared into the night. Christopher Thomas watched him go, cradling his savaged finger. The whole hand throbbed all the way to the wrist, and for quite a while he could do nothing except hold it to his chest and bite his lip. But the pain didn't die down. And finally, Thomas fumbled the keys into the ignition, started the car, and drove carefully away.
Chapter 2 by Alexander McCall Smith. Such a generous host. Justine said that, and he thought, naive. She had been in Europe twice before, as she'd made a point of telling him just before the plane took off. A month in London in her sophomore year at that place near Austin, he could never remember its name, and then 4 months in Amsterdam at the Rijksmuseum on some sort of internship. That was where she'd learned about painting, or claimed to have learned. He had his doubts about that, but he had never openly expressed them. Not that open expression was necessary. Raising an eyebrow was often quite sufficient in the art world. Christopher Thomas looked at her over the cafe table. He smiled. "But the rich always are," he said. "I can't recall a single occasion, not one, where I've been entertained, how should I put it, parsimoniously by people with money. Can you?" She did not reply. And the reason, thought Christopher, was that she had never really been there. She met these people through the museum, but meeting was one thing. Social acceptance was another. It was different for him. Not only had he married Rosemary, but he had worked his way up through the art world. He had come from nowhere, but that was no disadvantage if you were a chameleon. Take on the local color. Think the local thoughts. It was easy. People in the art world listened to him, deferred to him. Justine reached for the bottle of Chablis that the cafe proprietor had placed on the table. She filled his glass, then poured a small amount into her own. "Well, I guess I'm not used to this," she said, feeling slightly out of step, slightly apart from this literal ivory tower, nothing new. It was the way she'd felt in graduate school, and just about every other institution. "But I must say I like it." He took a sip of the wine. "Of course. Who wouldn't? It sure beats work." He shook his hand with the bandaged finger at her in mock admonition. "Listen, this is work. Remember, this is a conference, and we're here on behalf of the museum, not because we want to spend 5 days in France, not because we want to stay in the Chateau Bellepierre, not because we want to sit in cafes like this and drink Chablis. We can go to Napa for all that." She laughed nervously. "Of course. It's just I forget sometimes." "Don't. Tell me again what happened to your hand." "I never told you the first time you asked." They lapsed into silence. She looked over his shoulder, blurring him out for a moment, to the small line of pollarded trees on the other side of the square. Under the trees, in a small rectangle of raked white earth, a group of men in flat caps were playing boule. Somebody was winning, she saw, and was being slapped on the back in congratulation. A small triumph. A little thing. Beyond the boule players and the trees and the church on the corner, a stout woman dressed in black was standing at the open doorway looking in her direction. Christopher looked at his watch. "We'd better get back to the chateau. It's 4 o'clock. There's a lecture at 5. I think we should be there." Everybody would be there. Every one of the 8 connoisseurs invited by their host and all 12 experts. They would listen, ask a few questions, then break up until drinks before dinner. It was hardly demanding. Justine drained her glass. At home, she would never have drunk wine at 4 in the afternoon, but this was France, and it seemed a perfectly natural thing to do. She felt almost happy. When Christopher had suggested that she come on this trip, she had at first been reluctant. She had not been away with him before, and she was not sure whether she wanted to. He was her boss. And although they had crossed the line on several occasions, he was married. And she knew Rosemary. She would never have initiated something like this herself. He had done it. He had pushed her into it at a vulnerable moment, and she had acceded. What else could she do? But inviting her to come on this trip seemed to be upping the stakes, flaunting their affair. Well, if he was ready for that, then perhaps she was too. She had nobody else in her life at the moment. Of course, he had girlfriends, everybody knew that, including Rosemary, or so people said. She thought back to their conversation about this trip. "You've heard of Carl Porter?" he'd asked. "The Porter Foundation?" "Yes," she'd said, though she hadn't, not until she'd Googled him. "Sometimes people forget there are real people behind these foundations. Carl lives in France and has for years. The money comes from cosmetics, lipstick, or something like that, cheap stuff. Anyway, Carl and his wife got bored with Palm Beach and decided to move to France. He was a big collector, and he knew what he was doing. It's a great collection now, and he likes to share it." It started to make sense to her. "Share it? You mean he might give us, the museum, something?" Christopher shook his head. "No. Carl is tight. He's looking for ways of taking it with him. So, this invitation. He explained it to her. Carl's idea of sharing is to invite people to come and tell him what great paintings he has. He has what he calls conferences. They last 5 days or so, sometimes a whole week. He invites other collectors and a bunch of people he calls experts from the museums and galleries. That's us. And we sing for our supper. Christopher smiled. Exactly. You won't have to do anything. It's just that the invitation is for two people from the museum. Of course, if you'd rather I took someone else, I'll come. Justine came back to the moment, staring at Christopher Thomas, his angular face, the permanent sneer on his lips. Christopher seemed pleased. For her part, she was under no illusions as to why he had asked her. He would need entertainment. He had actually used that word before when he referred to what was between them. She was entertainment. She could have been angered, but rather to her surprise she found that she was not. In a way, she was even flattered that he, the great Christopher Thomas, should find her entertaining. And what else did she have? She had long ago had the insight, which sometimes people did not get until much later on, that this was no dress rehearsal. You had one chance at life, and you had to grab what was offered you. She had worked her way up from circumstances few, if any, in the rarefied world of art even knew about, and she had no intention of going back. She'd kept her job because of him. Certain invitations came her way because he felt fit to pass them on. She was in France because Christopher Thomas liked her enough to ask her. If that meant that they shared a room, then that was not too much of a price to pay. She was a willing participant, something she had been telling herself for several weeks. Christopher drove back to the chateau in the rented Peugeot. It was not a long drive, as the chateau was barely 5 miles from the village. It was good land. The wide landscape of Charente stretched under the high Poitou-Charente sky. Here and there a major town, but for the most part a place of small villages surrounded by sunflower and wheat fields, vineyards, stretches of forest. The chateau had been virtually derelict before Carl acquired it from its last owner, an almost blind French colonel, the last vestige of a distinguished family that had lived there for 5 centuries. He had left much of the furniture simply because he could not bear to sell it, and had wept as he had shown Carl and his wife Terry round each room. Christopher had been there before on several occasions after Carl had moved the collection from the secure warehouse near Philadelphia, where it had spent the previous 18 months. Carl had wanted his advice, not only on the paintings he had, but on works he intended to acquire. Christopher was happy to give his opinions, and had even persuaded Carl to sell several paintings of doubtful merit or questionable provenance. This advice had been rewarded with a fee, a remarkably generous one in view of Carl's reputation for meanness, or occasionally with a gift of a small painting. Christopher had a Vuillard pastel, admittedly an undistinguished one, that Carl had given him in gratitude for brokering the acquisition of something that Carl had long been looking for. Christopher had held on to the Vuillard for a year before discreetly selling it to a dealer in Paris who assured him that it would be sold to a private client and not appear in the auction rooms. He knew that Carl looked at all the catalogues, Christie's, Sotheby's, Phillips, and if the Vuillard came onto the open market, he would see it, and would not be pleased. Christopher and Justine had arrived the day before, taking the high-speed train down from Charles de Gaulle and picking up the rental car at Angoulême. Justine had been fascinated by the chateau and somewhat relieved she had her own room. But that night, after dinner, Christopher had knocked on her door and she had let him in. It's a very old house, he had whispered. And I get so lonely. The main conference started the next day with a discussion of two of Carl's latest acquisitions, a Dürer and an early Hopper. The Dürer was introduced by a woman from Berlin who talked at great length. Look at the face, the way it leaps out of the background, caught by the light. Everything else is in shadow. Only the face is illuminated. Christopher nudged Justine. He was using a camera obscura. You read Hockney on that? A man sitting nearby looked disapprovingly in his direction. Christopher acknowledged the look with a nod. Justine suppressed a smile. She remembered a friend saying to her, Look, Justine, that man is using you. It's so obvious. And she knew that her friend was right, but said, But he's so amusing. He makes it fun. Don't you understand that? The Hopper was more exciting. It was not well known, and had languished in an obscure private collection for 30 years before Carl had the chance to buy it for a mere $4 million. A hotel room at night with a curtain moved by the wind. Classic Hopper territory, with its air of something about to happen. Carl gave the talk himself, his main performance of the week, and his audience listened with all the attentiveness of those who were being paid to listen, or, if not actually being paid, were the recipients of a week of hospitality from a man who had $4 million to spend on a painting of an empty room in which something indefinable was going to take place. Christopher's attention wandered, and he found himself looking at the back of the neck of the German woman who had talked to them about Dürer. German. Precise. A bit superior. Scholarly. She'd be fussy and out of place in San Francisco. Too stiff. Yet women like that were a challenge. Attainable, but not available. Which made her all the more interesting. This German woman, who now, for no reason, turned her head slightly and met his glance, crossed her legs this way then that, shapely legs, and smiled at him. He returned the smile. I'm not sitting next to you at dinner, Justine said to Christopher. But we'll see one another later. She touched him lightly on the forearm. Yes. Why not? He could think of several reasons why not. All of them good reasons. None to be revealed, of course. There were his appetites to be satisfied, and for now the lovely Justine would adequately fulfill them. He glanced at the German woman as they moved through to the dining room, a long room with a chambered, painted ceiling portraying an apotheosis. He was seated next to the German woman, a coup, and Carl was on her other side. They were clearly in favor. Carl, he said, pointing to the ceiling. You've told me before, but I've forgotten, the apotheosis above our heads. Who? Who's being carried up to heaven? Or who painted it? Who's being carried up? The great-grandfather of the man I bought it from, the colonel. The German woman craned her neck. And did he deserve it? In his view, yes. Said Carl. They laughed. Then the German woman turned to Christopher and said, I was hoping to be able to talk to you. He raised an eyebrow. She was more attractive up close, and the accent intrigued him. She sounded more Swedish than German. It was a request, or the intimation of a request. They were planning an exhibition in Berlin of a Flemish artist whose work was represented in Christopher's museum. Could he oblige? And they would reciprocate, of course, when the occasion permitted. The German woman spoke precisely. I could come and fetch it if you can't spare anybody. Sure. And I could show you San Francisco.
That would be very kind.
He noticed her skin, which had the sort of tan that some Northern European types get so easily, that soft golden color that he found irresistible. She was a few years younger than him, he thought, and he looked at the left hand, pure reflex. A ring, a garnet, but on the wrong finger. Just ornament. They slipped into an easy, friendly conversation. Carl was engaged to his left, and so they spoke through the first chorus and into the second. She was flirting with him. The signals were unmistakable. He felt intrigued. Slightly flattered, too.
"Where are you staying?"
he asked. "I mean, here. I'm at the back. I've got this great view. The river and a sort of folly at the end of the lawn."
"I'm on that side, too," she said. "I believe that I'm a few doors down the corridor." "Yes. Two doors, to be exact."
He thought that he understood perfectly. He was surprised, but happy. And he found her room easily. He did not see Justine at breakfast the next morning. There was a lecture at 10 when a man from the National Gallery in London was going to discuss Carl's collection of old master drawings. She would be there, and he could talk to her and sort it out. "She has no claim on me," he told himself. "No claim at all." But where was Justine? He felt slightly irritated. This was work. They had discussed that, and he did not want her to give offense to Carl by not turning up at his carefully orchestrated events. Then he half turned and saw her, sitting at the far end of the back row, her eyes fixed on the lecturer. She did not catch his eye, although he thought that she must have seen him looking at her. After the talk was finished, after some questions and some fidgeting among the guests, Carl looked pointedly at his watch. Then it was time for morning coffee, which was served on the terrace. The light outside was bright, and Christopher slipped on a pair of sunglasses while he sipped his coffee. Justine came out and looked around quickly. Again, she must have seen him, he thought, but she made a point of going to speak to somebody else. He put his coffee cup down on the stone parapet that ran along the side of the terrace and walked over to intercept her. "Good morning." She looked at him coolly.
"Good morning."
He looked about him. The other guests were busy chatting to one another. He would not be overheard. "You're ignoring me." She feigned surprise.
"What made you think that?"
"Don't be disingenuous. You looked right through me back there." She hesitated, as if assessing how quickly and how far to ratchet up the tension.
"You're the one who's doing the ignoring."
She held his gaze, although she was looking into sunglasses and he into her eyes. He had the advantage.
"How is your German friend?"
she asked. "What?"
"Your German friend. Your new friend. I spoke to her this morning, just before the talk."
"You what?"
"She was surprised," Justine said. "She was surprised to hear that you were here with me." She thought.
Christopher turned and walked away. Justine followed him and grabbed hold of his arm. Her grip was surprisingly firm. He felt her nails digging into him. He tried to shrug her off, but her grip was tight. "What do you think you're doing? Not in front of everybody," he hissed.
"Nobody's looking," she whispered. "Listen, Christopher, have you ever thought of this? One day, one of the people you use will do something to hurt you. I mean, really hurt you."
He kept his voice down.
"I don't know what you're talking about." "Oh, don't you?" No. Justine left him, and he rubbed his arm where she had seized him. He would make her answer for this. That evening, Carl said to him after dinner, Chris, come and look at something really interesting upstairs. Just you. Of course, Carl. Now? Carl nodded and led the way up to the second floor, to a room that Christopher had never before been in. The small private salon was hexagonal for the shape of the tower space it occupied. The overall feeling was one of intimacy. A large bookcase, small paintings on the wall, a tapestry above the fireplace. Poussin, said Carl, pointing at a picture of a man sitting in an Arcadian landscape. A lovely little picture. Blunt wrote about it, you know. He drew my attention to it. Carl closed the door behind them so that they were away from the eyes of anybody who might be in the corridor outside. Can't be too careful. Look at this. He opened a drawer in a small chest near the window and took out a painting about the size of a large book in a narrow gilt frame. Lovely, said Christopher. He bent over to peer at the painting. There was a woman and two youths, angels. The angels' faces were unmistakable. It could only be one particular artist. He stood up again. Very lovely. Carl was looking at him. You know what it... Christopher spoke quietly. I can see what it is. He paused. And what do you want me to say? Do you want me to say, yes, this is it? Carl shrugged. I don't want you to say anything about what this is. What I do want you to say is that you'll take it to San Francisco for me and hand it over to that restorer friend you have out there. You know the one. He'll do what's necessary. Christopher frowned. Why get me to take it? Can't you take it yourself? Carl laid the painting down on a table and looked at it fondly. I can't do that. I can't risk its being intercepted. You know I can't. He looked up at Christopher and held his gaze. Christopher did know. He knew that this painting, from the studio of Sandro Botticelli, and probably from the artist's hand, could not fall into the hands of customs. So, Carl went on, you're perfect. Did anyone ever tell you that your face, Christopher, is the quintessential honest face? Successful museum director on his way back from a meeting in France? Nobody's going to stop you and say, do you mind telling us something about that little painting you have concealed in your suitcase, Mr. Thomas? Christopher looked at Carl, who was studying him intently, a bemused expression on his face. Sorry to have to say this, Christopher, to an old friend. But those who have been party to my confidences, and then have forgotten to keep them, have become unwell. Quite unwell. Christopher couldn't believe Carl was threatening him. He moved back toward the door. Well? Asked Carl. I have to say yes, don't I? Said Christopher. Carl slipped the painting into a velvet sack and handed it to him. Christopher stashed the painting in his room, then went to the drawing room, where the other guests were seated, enjoying conversation over late-night cups of coffee. He sat down. Neither Justine nor the German woman was there. After a few minutes, he excused himself. His encounter with Carl had left him feeling raw. The following morning he knocked on Justine's door, and when she opened it he leaned forward and kissed her. She turned her cheek and looked away. "Please, let's not be children." He took her hand. "There's something I need to ask you to do. Can you be discreet?" "Of course I can, you know that." "We need to get a painting back into the States. Can you take it in your cabin baggage? The painting is not large." "Why me?" He used Carl's line. "Didn't anyone ever tell you how innocent your face is? And how lovely?" "What sort of painting?" "You'll know when you see it." He paused. "So you'll do it?" Justine thought a moment. "Yes. I'll do it."
Chapter 3 by Raymond Corey. "I'm seeing him this evening," Christopher Thomas said into his cell phone as he stared out the glass wall of his office at the marina below. "I'm going there at 6.
"Call me when you're done," the voice on the other end said.
The curator demurred. "It'll be late for you. I'll call you in the morning, your morning, and let you know how it went." A small smile curled up the edge of his mouth as he listened to the silent acquiescence on the other end of the line. He wasn't being unreasonable. Carl Porter was in France. Christopher was in San Francisco. There was a 9-hour time difference between them, and Christopher knew full well that 3 or 4 a.m. conversations with anyone were best avoided, especially when they were about something as sensitive as what they were discussing. But it wasn't just about being reasonable. It was more than that. It was about keeping the upper hand, keeping control. And if there was one thing Christopher Thomas was good at, it was staying in control. Even in situations that he'd been forced into, such as this one.
"I'll expect your call at 7,
Porter grumbled back, clearly unhappy with being dictated to.
"Count on it,"
Christopher replied before hanging up, his pulse racing with mixed emotions. Hadn't liked being forced, even threatened, by Porter into smuggling the Botticelli into the United States. Christopher Thomas wasn't used to being forced to do anything for anyone. But his anger had gradually been superseded by greedy exhilaration at the potential outcome of it all. He stood to make a lot of money from the sale of the painting, and that was nothing to be angry about, especially now when he needed it. His eyes lingered on the view outside his office. It was a prestigious view, one that spoke of status, one that only a man who had attained a certain level of success in his line of work could ever hope to have. It was the view of a man who had arrived. The McFall Art Museum had a prestigious location, too, on the northern waterfront of the city, right on Marina Boulevard, and as its star curator, Christopher had a corner office. He stood at the floor-to-ceiling glass wall behind his desk and took in a gleaming white gin palace that was gliding out of the marina down below, his gaze eschewing the magnificent Golden Gate Bridge that stretched beyond, and locking instead on 2 tanned, bikini-clad playthings cavorting on the yacht's rear deck. The sight stirred something within him, a hunger that had driven him for as long as he could remember, a hunger for bigger and better things. A hunger that, if anything, his conversation with Carl Porter was about to help nourish if he played his cards right. He watched the yacht drift away, checked his watch, then turned and sat at his desk, taking in the sumptuous world he'd created for himself in his office. Suddenly, it seemed to pale by comparison, despite the cosseting it offered and the wealth of character it presented. It had never failed to impress those who had been invited into its hallowed ground. Exquisite chairs and side tables by Frank Lloyd Wright and Michael Graves spread out around his sleek Ross Lovegrove glass and steel desk.
a grandiose B&B Italia shelving system housing his perfectly arranged collection of hardcover art books, many of them signed and inscribed for Christopher by the artists whose works they contained. Posters of past exhibitions Christopher had put together over the years, showcasing the works of some of the biggest names in contemporary art, and the space for rotating works of art borrowed from the museum's collection, currently a huge self-portrait of Chuck Close that dazzled in its intricate patterns of color, adding to the splendor of the office. It was a splendid place to work, but it wasn't enough. He wanted more. Much more. He checked his watch again and let out a deep breath. 4 hours to go. He hated to wait, but he didn't have a choice. He leaned back in his plush Ames desk chair, shut his eyes, and focused on the money that would soon be in his hands. He arrived early at the restorer's premises and, as a precaution, parked a block away before walking briskly to the workshop's entrance, a black leather portfolio held firmly in his hand. The restorer answered the buzzer himself and let him in, the studio's heavy steel door clanging shut behind him. "Always a pleasure to see you, my friend," Nico Bandini said as he shook his hand heartily. "And just in time for a nice little shot of grappa to kick off the evening, yes?" "Perfetto," Christopher answered with a smile. "Who am I to break with tradition?" He followed the gregarious art restorer through the high-ceilinged studio. All around them, a small army of craftsmen in white overcoats sat hunched at their workplaces, toiling away like monks in a medieval scriptorium, peering with supreme concentration through their magnifying lenses, painstakingly cleaning and repairing valuable works of art, seemingly unaffected by the heady smell of paints, oils, and varnishes that smothered the loft-like space. "Busy?" Christopher said, more an observation than a question. "I'm doing all right," Bandini replied. "There is always a demand for fine arts, especially when the economy is this good." "That's true. You can always find a buyer when it comes to the arts," Christopher noted, consciously positioning himself for what was to come. "If you can even call some of it art," Bandini scoffed. "People are willing to pay through the nose for some ridiculous polka dots printed up by one of Damien Hirst's minions." He shook his head. "The world's gone crazy, hasn't it?" "In more ways than one. But hey, I'm not complaining. Nor will you when you see what I have here." Bandini smiled, then led Christopher into his office, closing the door behind him. "Hit that lock, too, would you?" Christopher asked. "Of course," the restorer clicked the lock into place. "I know this isn't a social call. So what have you got for me this time?" Christopher set the portfolio on the restorer's cluttered desk. "Have a look." Bandini unzipped the black leather case and pulled out the small package. It was the size of a coffee table book wrapped in a sack of dark brown velvet. He reached in and pulled the framed canvas out and held it in both hands, studying it with pursed lips. Christopher suppressed a smile as he watched the man's eyebrows rise and heard him let out an admiring whistle. "Provenance?" "Blue chip," Christopher replied confidently. "Private seller. I've got all the relevant paperwork." "Ah," Bandini observed curiously. "So whoever buys this can actually hang it in his living room." Christopher smiled. Most of what he brought to Bandini were works he'd borrowed from the museum's collection. He'd chosen ones that wouldn't be missed or replaced the ones that might be with forged copies created by Bandini's own craftsmen. The Botticelli was different. "They can hang it on their front porch for all I care. As long as they pay enough for the pleasure." "What do you think that pleasure's worth?" the restorer asked. It's a great piece, and it's unquestionably from the master's own hand, not from some acolyte in his studio, as I'm sure you can see. The man frowned. Don't sell me, Christopher. I know what it is. The curator shrugged. 3 is easily fair, I think. Might get more at auction. But given the circumstances, and in the interest of getting it done quickly, I'll take 2.8 for it. Christopher studied the restorer's face, gauging any micro-reactions that rippled across his features, looking for confirmation that he had pitched it at the right price, but not really expecting to get it. As expected, the restorer didn't even bat an eyelid. They'd both done this many times before, and like consummate poker players, they both knew how the game was played. Bandini stayed silent, his face locked in concentration. Doable? Christopher pressed, his mind processing the cut he'd be getting. Anything above 2.5 is yours, Porter had said. At 2.8 million, Christopher stood to clear $300,000, tax-free. Not bad for an afternoon's work. The restorer pondered the question for a moment, his gaze not moving off the painting he was still studying. Then his face relaxed. Possibly. Actually, more than possible. Probable. I think I have the perfect buyer for it. Bandini grinned at the curator. A gentleman from the home country. Botticelli would be pleased. The restorer set the painting back down onto the portfolio. I'll call him tonight. His expression turned curious. So you're in a bit of a rush to get this done. Any reason I should know about? It's not me. It's my seller. He's got time issues. Ah. So, you seem reasonably confident you can get this done, right? I think so, Bandini said, his tone now noticeably drier. So you wouldn't mind giving me an advance? The restorer's face curdled. I thought you weren't in a rush to get paid. I'm not, but... Christopher hesitated, brushing the man's question away while feeling droplets of sweat popping out across his forehead. You know how it is. Are you having money problems, Christopher? Bandini asked, dead flat, and eyed Christopher's bandaged finger. Christopher slid his hand behind his back. No, I told you I'm not, the curator shot back, slightly too strongly, he thought, a second too late. He dredged up a carefree smile. Look, it's not a big deal, okay? I just thought that since we both know you won't have too much trouble offloading it, a small advance wouldn't be an issue. The restorer studied Christopher quietly for a moment. I don't do advances, my friend. You should know better than to ask. And you know why I don't do advances? Christopher felt his temples heat up. Why? Because people who need advances have money problems. And people with money problems tend to get desperate. And when people get desperate, they get careless. And that worries me. It worries me a lot. Bandini's eyes narrowed. We've done a lot of business together over the years, Christopher. Should I start worrying about you? No, 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 the curator insisted. Don't be ridiculous. It's fine. Pay me when you sell it. It's not a problem, all right? Christopher flashed a radiant, magnetic smile that had played no small role in getting him what he'd wanted throughout his life. The restorer studied him coldly for a long beat, then his face relaxed as if the strings pulling it taut had snapped. Of course, he said, patting Christopher on the shoulder. It shouldn't take long. Now, how about that shot of grappa? Bandini was deep in thought as he made his way back into his office after seeing Christopher Thomas out. The painting was good, there was no doubt about it. He knew he'd be able to get more than $3 million for it. He might even orchestrate a mini-bidding war for it, he mused. A Botticelli of that quality didn't come up for sale too often. But something else was worrying him. The curator. He seemed edgier than normal. Bandini could sense it, and edginess, he knew, was a reliable harbinger of trouble ahead. Trouble that was best avoided, or eliminated. He called his two favored clients, one after the other, describing the work to them and arranging to drive it around and show it to them in the morning. Then he made another call, this one to a man who was definitely not a client and who wouldn't know a Botticelli canvas from a Banksy print. "I need you to keep an eye on someone for me," he told the man. "My supplier. You know the one I mean." "How close?" the man asked. "Microscopic," Bandini replied, before filling him in on what he was worried about. On the way back to his office, Christopher Thomas was buzzing with nervous energy. He tried to focus on the positives. Bandini hadn't flinched at the price he was asking. Christopher was pretty certain that the restorer would deliver, and soon. He usually did. But the man had also spooked him with his insistent questioning and his probing stare. Bandini, he knew, was no softy. He may have been supremely talented as a craftsman and as a forger, but he was also as tough as nails and worryingly unforgiving. Christopher had witnessed that firsthand. The museum's offices were mostly empty now, with only a few of his staff still around, notably those dealing with the Far East and working around the daunting time difference. He stepped into his sanctum and crossed to the small array of bottles sitting on a gleaming Art Deco tray where he poured 3 fingers of Tyrconnell single malt into a fat crystal tumbler. He raised the glass and watched the light dance across the amber nectar within its chiseled edges, then brought it up to his lips, the spicy bouquet of vanilla and oak tickling his nostrils before the liquid slid down his throat. Then he heard her voice. In his office, coming from behind him, by the door.
"Where do you go? I saw you walk out with a portfolio."
He turned. Justine was standing there, uninvited. "Most people knock," he said as he turned away, then took another sip of whiskey. "No, actually, scratch that. Not most people. All people. Everybody." He heard the door click shut, then she said,
"Most people wouldn't help you smuggle a small 15th-century masterpiece past customs either, would they?"
He turned again, in time to see a small, self-satisfied grin spread across her pretty face.
"Actually, scratch that. No one would. So I guess that buys me some dispensation from the protocol, don't you think?"
He exhaled slowly, then said, "What do you want, Justine?"
"You've been avoiding me. I'm getting worried that our little partnership is going off its tracks."
His eyes narrowed. "Our partnership?"
"Hey, I carried the damn thing in," she said as she stepped closer. "I was the one holding the bag. Literally. You made me risk everything for that damn painting."
"What risk?" he said, scoffing at the idea. "You saw how easy it was. Just like I said it would be. Besides," he pressed on, his voice taking on a sharper, angrier note, "I don't remember forcing you to do anything." The flash of doubt in her eyes found an echo in his satisfaction.
"Where is it?"
she asked. "It's none of your business."
"None of my business? It couldn't be more my business if I'd painted the damn thing myself. We're partners in this, Chris. Remember that. And, like it or not, you're going to give me my fair share."
"Or what?" he rasped, feeling his pulse quicken as he set his glass down on the table and looked at her with eyes that sizzled with menace. Justine felt a surge of paralyzing fear.
She'd never seen this side of him before, and she gasped as he got up from his chair and came at her with lightning speed, crossing the room in 4 quick strides and taking her by surprise. Grabbing her with both hands, he pushed her backward until they both came to a slamming halt against the inside wall of his office by the door. One of his hands tightened against her neck.
"Before you threaten me, darling," he hissed, "you need to make sure you've got what it takes to see it through."
She froze as his face hovered inches from hers, his breath heating up her cheeks, his teeth bared at her like those of some kind of gothic beast, his eyes narrowing as they drilled into hers. Her lips were quivering.
"You don't know what I'm capable of, Christopher,"
she whispered, trying to keep a tough edge to her voice, but knowing she wasn't pulling it off. She felt his fingers tighten even more around her neck, heightening the fear coursing through her. A vein in his temple was throbbing with mad fury, and his gaze was still locked on her as he edged in closer, his lips now brushing against her earlobe, the prickle of his stubble teasing her neck.
"Oh, we both know you're capable of some very surprising things, don't we?"
Chapter 4 by Jonathan Santlofer. The main gallery of the McFall Art Museum was buzzing. The art world was out in force, curators and collectors, artists and dealers, in high-end designer clothes, tattoos, the latest fad, etched across backs, creeping up the arms of young and not-so-young men and women. No one looking at the art. Everyone busy reciting his or her resume, affecting ennui, eyes flitting like hummingbirds seeking someone, anyone, more important to talk to. Rosemary Thomas stopped a moment to catch her breath, leaned against the wall to survey the blur of mostly black-clad cool cats and sophisticates, many of whom she'd known for years, but whom among them could she trust? Did they know? Were they laughing at her? Poor Rosemary, that husband of hers, well, you know. The thought of it, that she was a joke, someone to be pitied, unbearable. Ironic, she thought, fixing on the dazzling and disjunctive centerpiece of tonight's reception. A 10-foot-long, 1947 Jackson Pollock drip painting, the artist at the height of his manic creative powers. The kind of painting that rarely, if ever, became available, a gift that she helped Christopher acquire for the museum. Their museum, as Christopher liked to call it. What a joke. Christopher, a hotshot senior curator of 20th century art, while she remained a mere associate in arms and armor, a musty room that attracted even mustier old men and unwashed teenage boys. But wasn't that the way they'd planned it? Christopher's career to be the one that mattered. "I couldn't make it without you, babe." How many times had he said that? And she'd believed him, content to play the quiet, supportive wife with the right pedigree. Shaker Heights family, coming out party, Wellesley undergrad, New York's prestigious Institute of Fine Arts. The museum owed much of its reputation to her. It was because of her family's long-standing social connections that she'd easily made contact with old European families and had them donate rare pieces to her museum rather than the bigger, glitzier California institutions. And now, Christopher was building the contemporary collection, the cool stuff that brought in a public who didn't care much for armor and gothic goblets, hermetic stuff, old and dry, exactly how Rosemary was feeling these days. Like a relic, old and uninteresting, once the backbone of the museum, now ignored, ready to be discarded. "We've outgrown each other." "You mean you've outgrown me?" "I want a divorce." After all she'd put up with, the women, the humiliation, and now he wanted a divorce. "I won't let you divorce me." "How can you stop me?" Christopher's face, the sneer on his lips, burning in her mind as another man's face came into focus. "Oh!" A quick intake of breath. "Tony!" Are you okay? Me? Oh, yes. Yes, of course. Can he see it? The shame on my face? You look flushed. No, I'm fine. It's just these events, you know. Yes, hard work for a curator, but it's surely fun for me to see the museum acquire such a spectacular piece. Thanks to you. That's it, the right thing to say. Well, not me entirely. Tony Olson shrugged, modest, or trying to be. As a generous donor and chairman of the board for the past 4 years, he had shaped the museum's direction, and during that time, he and Rosemary had become good friends. Christopher had a lot to do with it. You must be very proud of him. Yes, of course. She swallowed hard, felt the blood rush to her head, nausea rising. Are you sure you're all right, Rosemary? Tony laid a hand on her shoulder. She tried to smile, Christopher's face still looming in her mind, his words like acid in her gut. But the children, they'll get over it. Let me get you a drink. That's the last thing I need, Tony. We were so busy I skipped dinner. Not a good idea. But I'm fine. Really, I am. He looked into her eyes. Rosemary, we all know how much you helped with this acquisition. It's not even your department, and Christopher getting all the credit. It isn't quite fair. Oh, I'm better at writing grant proposals and soliciting donations than socializing. You're a lot more than that. You're the anchor around here. The image struck her as unflattering, a weight that dragged things under. She touched his arm, felt the plush cashmere under her fingertips. You should mingle. It's your duty. Tony Olson gave her cheek a peck and smiled warmly before he moved into the crowd with the kind of ease Rosemary admired but could never muster. An anchor, that's what I am. A dead weight. But she'd been a good wife to Christopher, encouraging, willing to take a back seat, allowing him to shine, to be the star. She'd always known that was what he wanted. She stared at the crowd. At least half the art lovers had their backs to the Pollock masterpiece. My God, you look awful. Peter Hewson eyed his sister over the rim of his champagne glass. You're as white as a ghost. What's the matter?
Nothing.
Was it something that oily billionaire Olson just said?
No, of course not.
Rosemary tracked Tony Olson, watched him expertly chatting up half a dozen people at once. You know he made his first million in munitions.
I don't believe that.
Your naivete is a continual source of amazement, Peter sniffed. Well, I don't like him.
You don't like anyone who has more money than you.
That makes everyone, doesn't it?
Oh, please, Peter. We have the same trust, so I know exactly what sort of income you have, and it's plenty. You should be grateful.
My dear sister, you play grateful so much better than I.
Let's not get into this. Not here.
Rosemary sighed. Into what? You mean the loan I asked you for? The one you refused? Rosemary tried to whisper, but it came out a hiss.
We get the same monthly money, Peter. I just don't spend mine the way you do.
That's obvious. Peter gave his sister the once-over, top to bottom. Aren't you expected to dress for these events?
Very funny.
Rosemary smoothed imaginary wrinkles from her plain beige dress. Not funny at all. Peter angled his chin toward the center of the room. Look at your husband all decked out in his designer tux. Clearly he has no problem spending your money. Why aren't you on his arm?
He's got a lot of people to juggle.
Yes, Christopher's specialty is juggling, isn't it? He should have been in the circus.
Not now, Peter.
My God, Rosemary, you play the martyr even better than grateful, defending that lout while he makes a fool of you.
Keep your voice down, Peter. Rosemary scanned the nearby crowd to see if anyone was listening, but they were all too wrapped up in themselves to notice. Why? Everyone knows. He's not exactly hiding his affairs. Rosemary's legs felt weak, her face on fire, but she said nothing. Well, if you're just going to stand on the sidelines and pout, I'm off.
That's a good idea, she said.